dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people who I think are playing a more outsized role in helping the rest of us understand what's going on in that war and helping also shed light on what we need to be doing to help us, the good guys, prevail in it than our first guest. He is Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor turned, well, pundit, commentator, best-selling author, the columnist at the National Review and PJ Media, par excellence, and a man who I'm privileged to call a friend and always to have as a welcome guest. Andy, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us. Good to have you with us.
Frank, thanks for having me.
I'd like to talk first about yesterday's hearing on Capitol Hill involving the former Director of National Intelligence and the former Deputy Attorney General, I guess Acting Attorney General, Sally Yates. Would you give us your read on what came of that hearing, Andy, in particular with respect to this charge that there was some kind of Russian interference in the 2016 election and possibly collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians?
Well, Frank, I think this continues to be a narrative in search of backup evidence to support it. And I think the appearance in particular of former acting Attorney General Yates, who was fired for insubordination by President Trump, and I think rightly so, that seems to have resuscitated the story. But it hasn't advanced it in the sense of convincing anyone that there's anything that they can hang their hat on. You know, it seemed to me that it's an exercise in proving up innuendo or offering up innuendo, and it's a demonstration of why a congressional committee is a very poor vehicle for getting to the bottom of a alleged misconduct, whether it's criminal misconduct or national security misconduct. But what we know is that there were concerns raised over the fact that General Flynn, who was the designate to be Trump's national security advisor, had a conversation with the Russian ambassador in which the topic of the sanctions that President Obama had just imposed, this was in late November, I believe, in which that topic came up. And it was inevitable that it would come up because it was the same day that the sanctions got announced. We know from leaks in the newspaper that whatever was said about the sanctions, Flynn did not give the Russian ambassador any satisfaction. There's obviously a miscommunication between Flynn and Vice President Pence, which led to the administration claiming incorrectly, as it turned out, that the topic of sanctions had not come up. We don't know, even though it's been just casually assumed that Flynn lied to Pence, we don't know that Flynn lied to Pence or whether they just, you know, Flynn said that he didn't promise them anything and, you know, Pence took from that that the topic never came up. We don't know if this is confusion or outright mendacity. It might be. There are things about General Flynn that I find disturbing. Little mentioned in the press is that he has written a best-selling book, which portrays Russia quite accurately as an implacable enemy of the United States. You have to wonder why, if Flynn knew that, that he would take blood money from the Putin regime, as he did in these appearances, evidently, and why he would be working for Erdogan, who was basically the Muslim Brotherhood in a government. Is beyond me. But, you know, fair is fair. I don't think that they've shown that he was a Putin puppet, which is what they want you to kind of buy onto but not prove.
One of the things that Donald Trump tweeted about, which does seem to be appropriate to any investigation of this kind, is Russian influence operations and perhaps interference in the election process in the past, at least, by Democratic individuals, that is to say, collusion with Russians and their efforts to influence events in the United States or simply make money. That seems to have been almost entirely absent from the conversation yesterday and, more to the point, from these investigations. Should it remain that way?
Well, no, of course not. You know, it's and you wonder why it's why the Republicans aren't making more of this. You know, I wish President Trump wouldn't tweet these things because I think there are better ways to make these points. But at the same time, no one else is making them. So it's a little bit frustrating. But, you know, I mean, even the simple point that Flynn, and I think this is terrible that he did this, but Flynn took about $45,000 from this Russian propaganda outfit, RT. That's a bad thing. And I'm glad that they pointed that out. On the other hand, it's less than one tenth of the $500,000 that Russia paid Bill Clinton for a speech in the middle of a transaction in which Mrs. Clinton basically signed off on about one fifth of American uranium reserves falling under the control of the Putin regime. So, you know, I do think that I understand why it's happening because it's basically a media Democrat narrative, but there is a fuller picture of Russian interference in elections, and a lot of it historically has been for the benefit of the Democrats.
Yeah, it's just kind of mind-boggling. Maybe it's the swamp protecting itself. I can't quite tell what's going on with those Capitol Hill Republicans. But Andy, let me turn to another and related subject that you've been spending a lot of time and energy trying to help make sense of for us at National Review and PJ Media, and that is the Comey testimony last week on the various investigations that were conducted in connection with Mrs. Clinton's emails and this issue of what's going on with the Russians in our election process. Give us quickly, if you could, your distilled essence of what we should make of all of that.
Well, I think it's highly inappropriate, Frank, for the FBI director or anyone in the government to speak about the evidence that's amassed in an investigation that they don't charge. And while the Democrats are understandably upset about Comey's letter to Congress reopening the investigation 11 days before the election, there wouldn't be anything to complain about if he hadn't had this big press conference in July, which the Democrats were quite delighted to have him speaking about cases that didn't get charged because he basically saved the candidacy of Mrs. Clinton. But I just think it's best if prosecutors follow the rules and agents follow the rules, and that is you don't speak until you're ready to speak in court. That said, I think it's really idiotic to compare the, as the Times does and the Democrats do, the investigation of Clinton, which was a criminal investigation, to the FBI's investigation of people around Trump and their potential ties to the Russians, which is an intelligence investigation. They complain that he publicized one, that is Comey did, and not the other. But one of them is supposed to end up being public if it's actually going to be a prosecution. And the other one is presumptively secret and classified and shouldn't be spoken about at all. So I frankly don't understand that complaint, other than that it's a political complaint, which obviously makes it all understandable.
Andy, very quickly, if I could, in less than a minute, Jared Kushner's sister featured prominently in the New York Times the other day about pitching some Chinese investors. This has to do with something we'll be talking about more with Shay Armstrong momentarily. But talk a little bit about the propriety of that and whether it touches on illegality as well.
Well, I you know, the illegality, we'll have to look into it more to see if there's anything there. As far as of whether it's inappropriate, I mean, it seems to me that it's obviously inappropriate. And I also think, frankly, it's not very wise for the president. I mean, he'll do what he's going to do and he'll listen to who he decides to listen to. But, you know, the American people, including, you know, the people who supported him, voted for him. They didn't vote for Ivanka and Jared and you know, this is not, this is America. This isn't, you know, you don't elect a royal family. You elect the president. And I really think that, you know, this is something he may want to rethink. But, you know, who am I to tell him? He's a 70-year-old man who's gotten along pretty darn well on his own without a lot of advice from people like me. But I think he's in a danger zone with this stuff.
I think so, too. We're appreciative of your advice here, that's for sure, Andy McCarthy. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, I know you'll keep up your tremendous work at, well, among other places, Fox, but also PJ and National Review. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Shay Armstrong, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Shay Armstrong. He is a Dallas-based attorney who has specialized in the EB-5 program. We'll be talking with him about that program as it's in the news at the moment. He is the author of a terrific paper, a white paper, at the Center for Security Policy, published last August, entitled EB-5 Trojan Horse, How an American pay-for-citizenship immigration program poses a national security threat, focusing in on communist China as a case study. And that is the perfect send-up for what we want to talk to Shay Armstrong about. He's been quoted recently in the New York Times on this subject, so we know we're in good company, aren't we? Shay, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, so let's start by just level setting. Remind us what the EB-5 visa program is and how does it work?
Yeah, so Frank, in 1990, EB-5 came along as the employment-based category number 5, managed and monitored by USCIS. And the program, in a nutshell, is essentially it allows wealthy foreign nationals to earn a green card or to move to the front of the line, or to allow for expedited immigration by making a $500,000 investment into an economically underserved area in the United States. And this money usually goes into a real estate development project, such as a hotel or apartment complex.
The idea being that if you put money into such a enterprise in a depressed area, that you are getting an incentive to do so. But it's a pretty powerful incentive, isn't it? Essentially giving you an opportunity to come and ultimately become a citizen of the United States. Is that right?
That's exactly right. It's the ultimate commodity for these mostly Chinese nationals that take up 80 to 90% of the market.
Wow. Shay Armstrong is our guest. We're discussing a subject he is expert in, namely the EB-5 immigration status and what it allows, notably, a lot of Chinese folks to do in this country. And Shay, I want to turn to specifically this question of what Jared Kushner's sister, whose name is Nicole Meyer, was doing in Beijing the other day, promoting something called One Journal Square and flogging not only the EB-5 option, but also her friends and family members, including those in the White House these days.
Yeah, so it's standard within the EB-5 industry is go to China. These developers in the U.S. go to China, and for lack of a better phrase, they put on the dog and pony show, where they try to lure investors in, presenting their project at your Silk Satin hotels, your Ritz Carltons, and they'll go in there and put on their 30-minute show of their project to try to raise the necessary capital.
But this has something else going for it, which is that they're doing it in, as I understand it, Jersey City, is that right? Which would qualify as a depressed area, I take it?
Yeah, this is a whole other issue in EB-5, is that this money was intended to go to underserved markets, not just economically riddled areas, but areas maybe that are more fringe areas that need that extra push, that can't walk into your local Wells Fargo branch and get a loan. Once again, this project is located in an area where it's, I would say, it's very high end. You know, we have average salaries of they presented during their presentation, $100,000 and $200,000 per family.
So these folks would not qualify for the $500,000 version then. Presumably they would be required to put $1 million down, but they would nonetheless be able, if they do, to gain access to our country and perhaps in due course, if they choose to, become citizens of the United States. Give us again, Shay, you've written a white paper on the subject. Why are there concerns about this from a national security point of view?
Yeah, not to go too off topic, but to clarify, they actually got this project to be designated as a 500,000 economically distressed area.
Oh, no
project.
Kidding. how'd they do that?
Clever map drawing. You're able to move a little east, a little north, and you grab some area, and you're able to massage the economic unfortunalities of other areas to this particular area. So it did qualify. But in regards to, you know, the concern is we're seeing the largest Chinese developers become joint venture partners with some of the largest EB-5 deals. Well, number one, that wasn't an intent. This is supposed to benefit our own local developers. Number two, you know, from a patriotic perspective, at the least, why is a U.S. immigration program benefiting the largest Chinese-owned developers? And in this particular example, I believe it's Nicole Kushner or the Kushner sisters, when they're over in Beijing or Shanghai, they're working with state government actors in China, because these individuals that raised EB-5 capital are actually licensed by the Chinese government through the Exit Entry Bureau. So this is a direct correspondence, direct partnerships, raising this capital with Chinese state actors, which we all know what potential implications there are in those types of engagements.
Very troubling stuff indeed. Let's turn to this specific question, whether this is at the very least an improper use of influence in Washington, or perhaps in some way actually crosses over into a more serious legal problem for the Kushners. What's your assessment of that, Shay?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this continuing story. My group, actually, we were hoping for reform, because we think the intention of the program, it's a wonderful intention. You're bringing over people that are in Dragon Society, very few, and it's supposed to benefit your smaller developers. However, we've seen this political narrative go on now for about 6-7 years, from the Terry McAuliffe, you know, the Clinton scandal, to the Harry Reid pushing through visas for his own casino in his backyard, the SLS Casino in Las Vegas. And now we see it with the Kushner family. And so I think it's, it at least raises eyebrows in regards to Trump's base and the idea of being an immigration restrictionist. And now you have your son-in-law or a connection thereof hawking American citizenship or American residency in China.
Yeah, it seems to me it stinks at the very least. And I know you'll be following it closely, and hopefully others will as well, to try to prevent, again, what could at the very least be an embarrassment for the president, which I think is to be avoided, but also potentially a much more serious problem for the rest of us. Let us finish the conversation just by talking about Congress has apparently been giving some consideration to changing the EB-5 program, and I'd like to think in part it's as a result of some of the concerns you've expressed. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and what kinds of changes you think ought to be made.
Yeah, so there's been a clear bipartisan effort. We call it the Four Corners. Obviously, your ranking member and your chairman of each judiciary, your Grassley, Leahy, Conyers, and Goodlatte, that clearly say this program is not working the way it's supposed to be working, and the special interests involved are incredible. Well, we have a couple powerful senators on each side that are holding up the reform process. The real estate lobby, real estate development lobby, is a very powerful group. And if you're a silk satin developer using EB-5 in Lower Manhattan, EB-5 is working for you. And you're one of the few that can put up a $400 million apartment complex. Now, this is a limited market, so you have a handful of developers taking up all the EB-5 capital. And capital, honestly, they really don't need, even though this is coming from a capitalist perspective, they can get financing in many other mediums.
Well, this, again, is extraordinarily important work. And, Shay, I appreciate your staying on it, and we look forward to continuing our collaboration to illuminate why reform is needed, and I'm hoping very much so that this will result in further updates to your terrific paper from last August, EB5, The Trojan Horse. Shay, thanks for joining us. Keep up the good work and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Douglas Murray joins us from across the pond. We'll talk about the strange death of Europe, perhaps starting in France just this week. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a very high pleasure to say we are joined by Douglas Murray, a splendid, relatively young man out of the United Kingdom, who is formerly the Associate Director of the Henry Jackson Society and an Associate Editor of The Spectator in London. But beyond those titles, he is a man of great clarity, conviction, and articulateness, as is evidenced by, among other things, his superb collection of books and periodical literature, including one brand new one entitled The Strange Death of Europe. I'm thrilled to be able to introduce that book, as well as you, Douglas, to the audience. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to tell us about it and for your time today. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
You're a little the worse for wear, obviously, because you've been talking about this book nonstop since it came out, I think, a couple of days ago. Tell us a little bit about The Strange Death of Europe as you see it and as you're trying to translate it for the rest of us in the new book.
Well, it's really a work which has been in the mix for a while now. It's been traveling all across this continent of mine, of Europe, in recent years, in particular during the migration crisis, which has particularly sprung into the headlines 2 years ago in 2015. And it means that I've gone to the islands of Greece and Italy where the migrants come in. I've followed their stories up through the continent, gone to the places in the suburbs of French and German and Scandinavian cities where people end up. And the result of it all is this book, The Strange Death of Europe, subtitled On Immigration, Identity and Islam, because I think it's such a monumental story of our time. And people have been treating it as a sort of thousand word, you know, piece here, a story there, an attack here, a migrant wave there. And I think nobody has seen the scale of what this continent is actually facing, not just in terms of the number of the migrants, but the effects that they are having already on European societies, which I say in the book, my own view is that our societies are committing a form of suicide.
It does seem as though what we've unmistakably come to is a moment in which the tipping point may have been passed. And I ask you, as sort of a case study of the problem, what has just been formalized in terms of the election, the final election for president of France. Talk a little bit about the French sort of manifestation of this death of Europe and whether it is, in fact, beyond the point of no return.
Yes, the French election is an extraordinary event, but it should end up being between an outsider who doesn't even have a party and Marine Le Pen, member of the Le Pen family, leader of the Front National, is itself a depiction of the problem that the continent faces. I have several chapters in the book explaining why we do this to ourselves, why we've fallen for the idea that we are guilty, that we are to blame, why Europe has become exhausted civilizationally and culturally, because these things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen because we allow them to happen or because we can't resist them happening. And in the French context, of course, one of the things that is most interesting is that the most visible political response to this has come from, in this particular election, the Front National. Now, this points to a particularly difficult European problem, which is the question of how we can resist and react against the Merkel, Jean-Claude Juncker political class's view of the mass migration issue, without falling into the lap of the Front National. And this is a huge part of the problem. And I think you do have a bit of this in America, but it's nowhere near as advanced in as it is in Europe, where some of the available answers to our conundrums are themselves so unpalatable.
Mm. This really is the heart of the matter, isn't it? Of course, as you know so well, Douglas Murray, Europe has rarely been at peace for anything remotely like the duration of the post-war peace. And with the notable exception of Yugoslavia, it's really been quite a run. But one wonders whether these dynamics that are building up, on the one hand, the rising aggressiveness of the immigrant populations, many of them predominantly from Muslim countries in which sort of Sharia supremacism is the order of the day, on the one hand, and then populations that are clearly not finding outlets for their concerns about what's happening to their countries, to their societies, to their women, to their own lives. And I just wonder whether you see that as something that may be in prospect for Europe if it doesn't find a better way to address these concerns.
Yes, I mean, the big conundrum we're going through is the unasked question, which is, who is Europe for? Is it a place for the entire world? Is it a place where everybody in the world can come who wants to have a place called home? And if so, what is the home of the European peoples? Now, it's when you say the aggressiveness of some of the incomers, I don't see it as this. I see it as the big dilemma is that the impossibility of integrating people at this speed when they come from such a different place and background. And I think that this dream of integration is at the moment starting to flip, and it leaves Europe in the 21st century without a cohering idea of what we're doing here. And this itself is a very large part of the problem. And my own view is that, yes, it'll turn very bad. But the, as it were, the aggressive part of the immigration is a very small part of it. The much bigger part of it is this question of, who is this place for? Because this concatenation of events is this historically unbelievable movement of people into Europe at the same time as Europe has lost its sense of its own story. And these two things, it could survive one, but not both.
Not both, yeah. I guess what I'm talking about in terms of aggressiveness, I'm thinking not so much about, you know, the rape fests in Cologne at New Year's a year ago. I'm thinking really of the increasing assertiveness of the populations that are unassimilated as they demand more concessions, as they build infrastructure, as they essentially exclude the native populations in many respects from their enclaves and so on. And Douglas, let me just close with one additional fillip to all of this, which goes back to what I mentioned a moment ago, and that is the criticism that you, among others, have come under, particularly for flouting, as some would have it, the hate speech codes of Europe. Talk a little bit quickly, if you would, about the state of free speech on the continent and even in your homeland, the United Kingdom.
Well, in the United Kingdom, mercifully, we're better off in that regard than across a lot of the continent, where, yes, in France and other countries, people who said some of the things I say have been dragged to the courts. In Britain, we have a slightly better arrangement from that. But we do have this de facto version of the shutting down, which is, of course, to say that all discussion in this area is, of course, racist. And this, I think, is no longer going to work, or at least won't work for very much longer. The attempt to stop us having the discussion has actually made the discussion go worse. And we're overdue for it. I think that America, by the way, is overdue for it. Is a serious discussion of who we are, what we're doing, and what we want for our own future So, I mean, I think this is a huge parable and lesson for the United States of America, because you are going to go through and are already going through precisely the same movements as we have been.
Well, you're right. This kind of conversation, this kind of serious scrutiny that you have so well described in your new book, The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity, and Islam, Douglas Murray, is such a very, very important contribution to the debate. Thank you for taking some time to talk with us about it. I hope we might lure you on to discuss it at greater length sometime soon when your voice is in better shape. But thanks for finding a few minutes for us today. Kevin Freeman joins us next. We'll talk about economic warfare against you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow with responsibilities in the economic warfare space. He is Kevin Freeman, CFA. He is, among other things, the best-selling author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And prior to that, another bestseller, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Kevin is shortly to become the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman on the Blaze Network, and always a welcome guest. Kevin, glad to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Frank.
You have a story on your blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, about SWIFT. Remind us what SWIFT is and tell us why it's breaking news as you see it.
Well, SWIFT is the international payments system. It's out of Belgium. It is kind of the linchpin for when you want to send money from one country to another. And it has been subject to U.S. policy. They claim that they're independent, but we've used SWIFT in large part to affect, to monitor and to control international payments. And so it becomes a tool of economic warfare. Someone's a bad actor, we cut them off from SWIFT, and they can't send money out or get money into their country. And it's a very, very powerful weapon.
And because it's a powerful weapon, others have seen the importance of replacing it as an instrument of American economic warfare. Who are the contenders and what are they up to in that regard, Kevin?
Well, China, with the support of Russia, created CHIPS, which is the China International Payment System, CIPS. And the reason that they did this ostensibly is because, the claim is that they had to because SWIFT seemed to be vulnerable to hacking and other problems. And so they created, but Russia has claimed that the creation of CIPS was primarily to disengage the American control from SWIFT so that they could send payments wherever they wanted to. There could never be sanctions using SWIFT because there was now an alternative.
And to the extent that that alternative is now in place, what might it behoove them to do to undermine the existing SWIFT mechanism and make theirs a more attractive alternative?
Well, now this is where it gets interesting, because there were hackers that hacked and stole some $80 million from a Bangladesh transfer. It was an attempt at a billion-dollar hacking, but they hacked into the SWIFT system. They used Bangladesh codes, and technically they hacked into Bangladesh and then used those codes on SWIFT in order to reroute what turned out to be about $80 million. And it was a major, you know, international bank theft. But what it exposed was the vulnerability of the system to hacking. And here's where it gets really interesting. The NSA apparently has the ability to monitor SWIFT and has been monitoring SWIFT, and NSA tools to do that and possibly hack into SWIFT were released by a group of hackers onto the internet, now exposing how dangerous it is to transact in SWIFT, and the Chinese immediately jumped on that and as explanation for why they had the alternative. So what that sets up is the idea that China or Russia can hack into SWIFT, make a big deal about how vulnerable it is, and drive the rest of the world to their payment system, which means they would have the big economic weapon of the world.
Yeah, and as a practical matter, should that eventuate, Kevin Freeman, how might it be used as an instrument of economic warfare against the United States itself? Obviously, they'd be taking away an instrument from our kit that we've used to punish bad actors. Would it be conceivable that they could actually shut out the United States from international banking, transfers, or would they be doing something that's also damaging, but in smaller increments that might be more practicable?
Well, actually, it's they've stolen our gun, in a sense. If they're able to pull this off, they will have stolen our gun, and they can turn it and use it against us. The idea that they could completely cut the United States off from the global financial community would require more than just control of the transaction network. It would require all of our allies to say we no longer want to do business with America and so forth. So we're a ways from it being that end-all weapon. But it certainly sets the road to it. It certainly creates the opportunity that something like that could happen down the road if we were isolated from world opinion in one way or another.
A very worrying development. And Kevin Freeman, this is why I think the work you do at Global Economic Warfare Blog, and of course with your upcoming show, will be of such importance. Kevin, let me ask you about one other asymmetric warfare capability, perhaps, rather than strictly speaking an economic one. But you've written about the National Association of Scholars report about these Confucius Institutes that the Chinese have been placing on American campuses. Give us a bit of a flavor from your perspective, having studied closely what the Chinese have been doing in the nature of what they call unrestricted warfare, going back to the publication of a book by that name in 1999. What are these Confucius Institutes as you see it, and how do they fit into this kind of asymmetric warfare the Chinese seem to be waging against us?
Well, they seem to be. They appear to be patterned after something the Nazis did in the 1930s that, you know, it was denied at the time, but every reasonable scholar, including Dr. Stephen Norwood from the University of Oklahoma, has studied and said, yes, the Nazis infiltrated American universities, and they did it by setting up German studies programs. The Confucius Institute seem to be following along that same pattern, where they go into a college or university and offer to put scholars there as long as the scholars agree to abide by Chinese law and the university agrees to abide by Chinese law in reference to them, and they won't put out anything negative about China. So they are controlling the dialogue, which means they're controlling the learning taking place, who China is, what China is intending to do, and so forth. It is a form of information warfare, and they're doing it with, you know, in large part, their money coming in, but it's manipulating our tax dollars. The largest investment the United States government has, financial investment, is in student loans to the tune of trillions of dollars. So we're watching as they're manipulating our open university system to literally put out a pro-China policy.
And when you talk about the student loans business, are we actually paying the Chinese to come here? I thought they were paying us to open our universities to their students and, as a result, have essentially hooked the universities on that funding stream. They're paying full fare, these foreign students, at least in most cases. Is that not correct?
That is correct, but what they're doing is they're manipulating the university system that we're putting trillions of dollars into the university system. In other words, they're the tiny rudder that's steering the whole ship. We're putting the majority money in the universities, and they're putting a little bit, but they're controlling the direction of the ship.
especially when it comes to our understanding about China and presumably the attitudes of many of our students towards the Chinese. This is a critically important sort of political warfare instrument, I guess you might say. And Kevin, again, thank you for calling it to our attention. Kevin, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for joining us each week and for the great work you do in so many capacities, and we're looking forward to your coming program on the Blaze Network. Watch for it, folks. I hope you'll, in the meantime, be listening for us tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.